Live from the NBC News Radio broadcasting studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California and in parallel with the Turf's Up Radio Studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Welcome to The Water Zone. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. I'm your host, Rob Starr, along with our other great host, Mr. Chris Davey.
Good afternoon, Rob. How are you?
I'm good. I'm tired.
All right, me too. But, you know, hey, interesting at Riverside here today in California. Another fire
I
in
saw
the gully.
That. I saw that at lunchtime.
In the riverbed.
Yeah.
Because we had one, you know, a couple of months ago, and it did a lot of damage to the building. This one seemed to get out very quickly.
Yep. There's a lot going on down in that gully. Unfortunately, for our, just so our listeners know, there's a lot of homeless that live down there.
Large encampment.
And, you know, we're always worried that something's going to happen. I mean, we've had strange things happen in our company. We had a guy come into the lobby with a hatchet and threaten. We've had people steal, break into our buildings and steal things. And then there was those pigs.
Yeah.
Not people and not police,
but real wild boars
that were like big 200-300 pounders running around.
Yes. Just below the parking lot there. Yeah. And it made for a scary situation until that got fenced.
Yep. Didn't know if they were raising them or they stole them or whatever, or they're trying to cook them.
I think they were natural.
Well, I don't, how can they just be natural
occurring?
I don't know. That's kind of, and then they had a wild horse that was there for like 5 weeks running around crazy.
Yeah. Named him even.
Yeah.
Named the horse.
Yeah.
Came up into the pasture where we grow grass and chomping away.
Well, the good thing is our people helped take care of that. They made the right contacts with people, and they came and got the pigs. They came and got the horse.
That's right.
And so they're safely moved away, and now we just got to worry about the homeless people.
Yeah. So, you know, the good side of living right next to a river is you get a beautiful view in the winter, summertime of the riverbed and all of the trees in the river. It, the tough part is it's right next to nature.
Have you noticed that since we had the fire that a lot of that greenery grew back?
It did quickly,
on the ground,
very quickly. Yeah. There's even, you know, you can even see the ashes still on the in the topsoil.
Yep.
But the greenery is growing back very, very fast.
And as good stewards to this planet, we did get trees replanted.
Yes, over 200
trees
were planted to replace the ones that burned. Mm-hmm. Now there are smaller trees, and so have you noticed that as you walk out of the building down into the parking lot, your view is better?
Oh, yeah.
We don't have big, large pine trees and
blocking the view, but it's gorgeous out there.
Yep.
Anyway, so it's a good week. We have a lot of good things happening, and we have a great show today. We have one of our favorite people, Miss Chris Austin, the purveyor of Maven's Notebook, and then we have another guest after named Regina Hirsch. And but we're going to start off with our beloved lady of California Water News, Miss Chris Austin.
Welcome, Chris.
Chris?
Hello?
Hello, Chris. There she is.
Can you hear us? Chris?
Yes,
can
hello?
Can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, absolutely. We're on the air, Chris.
Okay, cool.
Live and in color. Go ahead.
Hey.
Thank you for sending
us. How you doing, guys?
We're great.
Good.
And thank you for sending us the paperwork. We appreciate that.
Oh, hey, no problem.
So.
Yeah, the big news this week is that yesterday they finally released the voluntary agreement, the negotiations that have been underway in the northern part of the state to try and come up with a better plan that's for species, you know, for the endangered species and for the environment, where the water agencies are putting some money on the table and some water on the table, and they're trying to get a better outcome than what the State Water Board has proposed.
Mm-hmm.
This has been going on for over a year, about, 14 months now, these negotiations, and not much has come out about them. So, you know, now the governor came out and introduced these voluntary agreements. And I'm just going to say I've been doing this job for like 13 years, and I never did see anything ever, any large, big announcement from the state come out in the way that it came out, which was through a commentary on Cal Matters, and, you know, from Governor Newsom, and that was how the news was broke, rather than a press release from a government agency. And I got wind of it because Metropolitan's sending a press release responding to something. So, you know, I kind of get on the phone and, you know, on the email because that's what I do, and I poke around. And I ask, well, here's a nice commentary, but where are the details? Well, the state didn't have the details yet, so it was all on this PowerPoint. And they're like, well, we're going to come up with a fact sheet maybe tomorrow. I mean, it was the most disorganized release of a major announcement event that I've seen.
Well, do you think that softer approach was any kind of peacemaking kind of you know, effort, right? Fig leaf or olive leaf, olive branch?
Well, actually, I mean, to be honest, I think it's just another sign of, you know, Governor Newsom's perhaps naivety. That maybe he was jumping the gun before his own people had all the other stuff. Usually when you make a big announcement like this, you say, hey, we got this big announcement, and look, here are the details. They didn't have any details.
Yeah, so kind of quiet.
So, yeah, but I think it is, you know, to me, and, you know, forgive me if anyone from the Newsom administration is listening, but it seems to me that it was like the governor jumping the gun on his own people because they didn't have it. And even today, I did not see a fact sheet on the voluntary agreements come out. But there was this PowerPoint that kind of laid out the details. And basically what's going on is the water agencies and the you know, the water agencies on the tributaries that all feed into the Delta on the Sacramento side and some of the San Joaquin River side, I do not believe it is inclusive of all the contractors, but some of them all came to the table and they said, here's how much water we're going to give up and here's how much money we're going to give up for the science. You know, to pay for figuring out what's really going on here and how to be better at doing what we're trying to do. And so this is what they've come up with. Reaction has been really mixed. Well, it's been the water agencies are very supportive of it, and the environmental agencies seem to be somewhat mixed. Some of them are saying yes, and some of them are saying we're not really happy. Although I didn't see any of the environmental NGOs sign on to it wholeheartedly yet. They're all saying, you know, what I saw was, you know, we're going to have to wait and see what comes, but, you know, this is a step forward, because the truth is that, you know, in the 13 years that I've been doing this, I've never seen an instance where water agencies have come together and they put water on the table and they put money on the table. They've agreed, these agencies that are participating in these voluntary agreements have agreed to put money I think it's $7 or $8 per acre foot of water they take from the Delta. They're going to put into a program for science to try and see how they can improve things in the Delta for the species.
Yeah, that's a good deal, and it's a big deal.
It's big. I can't recall ever, in the 13 years I've been doing this, that water agencies like this have come forward in this manner and have voluntarily put money on the table.
Well, maybe they see that all the things they did for all these years wasn't getting anywhere, so they had to change.
Yeah, well, exactly. And the environmental groups, you know, are not really signed on to this yet, it doesn't seem, but they're not signed on to it. So, you know, they've expressed things, but I haven't seen anybody seriously panic yet, but reaction's still coming in. I think because of the way that it all came out, it's taken a while for people to kind of figure out what it is that's going on here.
Yeah, usually with something of this influence, this big of a deal, right? I mean, they raise the flag and hire a brass band, but
yeah, like I say, I haven't seen, in my 13 years, I never saw anything like this come out, or a big announcement like this in this manner. But okay, so here it is. So and I it's really going to remain to be seen, what happens here. I know that a lot of the environmental organizations are not happy with all of the things that are being put on the table, but the alternative is if, we start litigation, then when these things start winding their way through the court,
years, millennia,
if not a decade or more, before anything happens to help the environment. Yep. And if we can go forward with these voluntary agreements, we can be putting things into action in the next year or so.
Yeah, when you look at all the appeals, all the injunctions, everything that can go down, it would take years to get something settled. And it's like anything else that everybody's dealing with in the government. You need to sit down, all the parties need to sit down and give a little. It's never going to be 100% of one side, ever. And if they both realize that and at least get something going positive, that's the thing. At least if they could agree to doing some positive things, it could be even in baby steps, but always go in a positive way. Don't stop this long process that they go on for years and years and years and years, and it just never gets done, ever. Changes of administrations over that time, and it's just crazy. So,
and that's sort of where they're trying to move forward, and we'll see how it works out into the future.
Yep, we'll be looking at that. We also saw some changes for the regional EPA chief in California got suddenly removed. What happened with that?
Surprise!
What did he do?
Apparently, they don't know, but I'm not sure when it comes to the Trump administration, you necessarily have to do anything in particular. watch Trump's Twitter feed to see if he has anything to add to it, because that's how he seems to announce these things these days. But that was sort of a surprise story. The guy's just out. It was interesting. Stork. I can't recall his first name. His last name, I believe, was Stork. He was one of the first EPA administrators, regional administrators, not to be in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is where the regional office is. He actually seemed to run it from here in Southern California, which is, not how it's worked in the past. So, it was kind of interesting to see, what was going to happen with that, and apparently, not a lot, because, now he's out.
You got the famous
they
line.
They had a hard time filling that position.
Oh. Can I nominate you?
Heck no. No. the amazing thing is, Trump has been sort of almost in a war with the EPA, you could say. He's been ripping apart the regulations and downsizing and doing all these things.
And he started out with Pruitt and everything else. It was a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it took him a long time to fill the position of regional administrator in the San Francisco or California area, which is based in San Francisco, because, we, for the most part, out here in California, especially in San Francisco, have a kind of different view. So it took them a long time to put somebody in, and finally put someone in, and now they're out. So who knows how long it will be before somebody new comes in. So we'll see.
You're in, you're out, you're in. Yeah.
Yeah, who knows?
We should do a lottery with this. We should do a lottery with everybody in government who comes and goes and comes and goes and comes and goes.
It would be a money management problem.
But it's really scary to know about, even if you just put it to the water industry, of all the people who are in it today, I see a lot of retirements coming in the next year to 5 years, and it's going to be a whole new change of scenery with people.
And it's really, you know, of concern because a lot of expertise is walking out the door.
Yep.
And that is institutional knowledge and expertise that we don't necessarily have access to. It's not stuff in books. It's stuff inside people's heads.
Right.
And it's really a concern. And it's also the same for the farming industry. Farmers are, you know, their median age is well over 50s, you know, 55, 56. I can't remember what it is the last time I heard, but, you know, we're not having a lot of young people aren't going to college and saying, I want to be a farmer.
Yeah.
And this is a big, you know, this is the big issue. Where are we going to get the people that are going to, you know, handle our water industry and do our farming in the future?
Well, you know, what I've noticed in this industry, I guess it's in a lot of industries, is not just the water industry or irrigation. People rise to a certain position where they're top senior management, they retire, and then they come back as a consultant and make twice as much as they made the first time. but that's happening a lot. I mean, and I'm not making fun of those people who do it, because if I could do it, I'd do it as well. But you know, we're doing this because we like to work, but we also like to get paid. But you know, bottom line, you can't afford to lose people with that kind of knowledge and just walk away and say,
yeah,
"Hey, I'm leaving." And even if they gave a 6 month or a year notice, it's still a lot of, you know, you're taking somebody with 30, 40 years of experience. You can't just walk away and not understand all the things that this person knows. It's scary.
Yeah, that institutional knowledge.
Let's put in a plug here. But what this does mean is there are a lot of job opportunities out there for people who are looking for work, who want a stable job, and not all of them require four-year degrees.
Absolutely.
So go to cawaterjobs.com, and you can find out more about how you could have a career in the water industry. Sometimes it just takes just a two-year degree at a community college. Not expensive to, and not impossible to attain.
No, even lower than that, you can go to places like Irrigator Tech, which is a great school for teaching people in irrigation. You know, my son is a plumber, and he doesn't work all the time. But what I said to him, I said, why don't you go to this school and learn how to redo and maintain backflow valves. It's a huge business. Every major building in the state has backflow valves.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And they need to be recertified and checked every year. I mean, there's
a lot of jobs.
Yeah, and good-paying jobs.
Yeah, a lot
good,
of jobs.
Good,
yes.
Good-paying jobs. So,
and they don't require a four-year degree at a college. So, you know, if there's anyone out there that's listening and you know, you're looking for another line of work and you don't want to spend, you know, 4 or 5 years in college, you know, look at the water industry. CAWaterJobs.com. I think you'll get a lot of information there.
Sounds good.
Yeah, excellent. There are a lot of jobs. I know many years ago, Brown and Caldwell would put out a weekly a note on California water jobs, and you could just sign up for their newsletter and see it listed.
Yep. So what are some other earth-shattering things that are happening around the state?
Earth-shattering.
Well, we had the first of the groundwater sustainability plans come out, available for public comment. The comment period or the submission period closed midnight on Friday, January 31st. So the Department of Water Resources personnel said that they would be available till midnight for people trying to figure out, you know, how to submit their plans through their portal. Hopefully, no one waited that long. But we have the first of the plans out, and these are for the critically overdrafted basins in the San Joaquin Valley. And more of them, as they get posted, you know, DWR has to review all the submissions, and when they're deemed to be complete, then they not complete, not approved, but complete, they are posted on their portal. So and a public comment period is open. So, you know, this is going to be interesting to see what happens here. If these plans don't meet muster, it does make them open to state water board intervention, which is, you know, nobody wants the state to come in and tell you how to manage their groundwater basin. And they've been very straightforward. They've said, look, we're not going to come in and try and figure out groundwater recharge projects and all that. We're going to come in and we're going to tell you to cut your pumping. So you might want to just make sure you get a plan in. So we'll see. You know, all the plans are being submitted. DWR has 20 days to, you know, check them over and make sure they're complete and then post them on the portal. There'll be at least a 60-day public comment period on those plans. So we'll see what happens. None of those plans were for any of us here in Southern California. They are primarily for the San Joaquin Basin and a few other groundwater basins, you know, like Borrego Springs and some areas in the Monterey area. But for the most part, they're centered in the San Joaquin Valley. So we will see what happens.
Right. Excellent. So I want to tell our listeners to get the latest everyday information in water, go to Mavens. Oops, I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
There you go.
There you go.
Yeah, we're coming up to the bottom of the hour break here. So, Chris, tell people where they can go and get the information.
Well, you just come to mavensnotebook.com, and I got it all there for you.
Yep, you can also become a sponsor of that and contribute to that. It's a great thing. We learn all our when Chris and I are Chris here and I can't get around all the time. We have Chris Austin on the show, so she tells us all the things that are happening. And I think the governor should put you on staff. I really do.
But I know you. I'm not sure Chris would want that.
Yeah. Well, I know you participated in the California Irrigation Institute thing, and our next guest was also a panelist at that as well. So, but again, go to mavensnotebook.com, and Chris will talk to you next week.
All right. Take care, guys.
Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. We're up against our break here, and we're going to have a few words from our sponsors and be back with our next wonderful guest. Her name is Regina Hirsch, and we're anxiously waiting to talk to her. So stick around. We'll be back in just 2 minutes.
Take a water break and talk some water. Irrigation. Such a refreshing topic. As more and more markets face water restrictions, your customers may be hungry, or should I say thirsty, for water-saving products. For new installations, add options like drip irrigation, controllers that respond to weather data, pressure-regulating heads, or heads with check valves. They all provide easy ways to differentiate your bids and win more jobs. Or for an extra stream of revenue, offer existing customers upgrades like high-efficiency nozzles, rotary nozzles, or Wi-Fi-based controllers. Because when you help your customers save water, you make a world of difference for the earth and your bottom line at the same time. We'll drink to that.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Oh, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes, a better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. EcoSeries products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco Solvent Cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
Hey, Green Industry Pros, are you new to Turf Surf Radio and want to learn more? Then plug in your earphones and keep listening, because Turf Surf Radio invites you to listen while you work. Our 24/7 live radio platform keeps you up to date, bringing you new tips and interviews from pros like you who want to elevate and educate the green industry. Can't make it to industry shows or events? Don't worry, Turf Surf Radio will be there bringing you live coverage, getting you in on the action. So keep listening to Turf Surf Radio, your industry, your station.
Okay, welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone. We have another wonderful guest. Her name is Regina Hirsch. A little background. Regina is the founder and executive director of Watershed Progressive. It's an outside water design, build, consultation, and education firm. Watershed Progressive serves clients from the residential scale to large institutional multi-phase projects such as the National Guard Stormwater, Low-Impact Development Plan, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo Stormwater Catchment.
The real Cal Poly.
That's right. You went to the real Cal Poly. Is there really a lot of contention between both of those? And they also did a thing called Project Evergreen and Rush Creek Lodges gray water and stormwater harvesting projects, all totaling several million gallons of water per year.
Saved water per year. So Regina also is an executive director for multiple organizations and as a consultant for state and regional government policy bodies. Regina is also a developer and co-organizer of the annual Localizing California Water Conference, right? So we'll hear a little bit more about that from her later. We'll learn what that is. Also a co-owner of Mountain Sage Nurseries up in Groveland.
And there's a special deal about that that you're going to have to do. A little history that I found out about.
I am aware. I was going to leave it for a little surprise for the listeners. But Mountain Sage Nursery is up in Groveland, California. And for those of you who aren't aware, it's in the foothills just east of Stockton, Modesto area. And yes, there's a great story coming up for that. So Regina is dedicated to bringing appropriate best management solutions to the public. She's an ardent advocate for the natural and community benefits of watershed hydration. So let's bring Regina onto the show.
Regina, welcome.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Great to be here. And
I appreciate that. So the question we always like to ask people is like, how the heck did you choose your current career path? How'd you get in this business?
Oh, my gosh. I said, you know, really, it comes from my grandmother up in Groveland.
If I can interrupt you for a second, are you on a cell phone?
I'm on a cell phone.
Oh, because you're going in and out on signal. It's hard to hear you.
Is there a better place in your home to go?
Well, let's find out. Just a second.
So, you know, left arm in the air, head out the window kind of thing.
Do you have any tinfoil?
Yeah, well, let's see. All right.
So that's a little better right there.
Yeah. We just want our listeners to hear you.
You're a little better right there in the last sentence you had. Doing okay?
Are you there?
Nope. We've lost Regina. So hopefully she'll call back in. Yeah, hopefully she'll call back in. But, you know, we can talk a little bit and we can just give a heads up on what the water
is. So are you betting, is that a 3G, 4G, or 5G system?
Yeah. So usually pretty good up there. I mean, you know, I spend a lot of time up in the Modesto, Stockton area, mm-hmm. and usually get great signal everywhere. So hopefully that'll work. So
yeah, when I talked this afternoon, it was perfectly clear, no problems whatsoever. And somebody's calling in right now. I think our engineer is Freddie is picking it up. And he's giving it the once over. He's got to give us the thumbs up. And
one, two, buckle my shoe.
Are you back with us?
I am back with you, but so sorry about that. Can you guys hear me?
It happens.
It's a little bit better. Yep, you bet.
So, great.
So back to what brought you into the industry, into this line of work?
Well, I think my grandmother, who worked towards trying to find solutions for her community up in Groveland, really inspired me. But, you know, I went to school for physics and ecology and got wrapped up in the Regional Water Board in Morro Bay and San Luis Obispo. And while I was working there, I did a lot of monitoring for the watershed and rangeland management and different treatments that we could use, best management practices, they're called. And during that, I really found a love of trying to understand how the different ways we apply land management can affect our watersheds, our waterways, and our water supply. And then, quite frankly, I met my husband, and we moved up to Groveland in order to be close to my grandmother. And we founded a Mountain Safe Nursery, no surprise. As I started to learn about plants and understanding how plants work and how the systems really could affect different land use treatments, and I learned about irrigation, of course, I realized how much water we're using and different approaches we could use, and I wanted to try to understand that through monitoring. And that's where I was asked to go back and do some assessments back in San Luis Obispo and Morro Bay, in the Tuolumne County foothills, and I started to understand more and more that we needed to have different approaches to what we do in our backyards, but also our businesses, and that led to pretty much the line of work I'm in.
So Robert talked about in the intro a number of the organizations that you work with, just one or two of them. But I know just by reading the bio how much broader that is, Regina. So can you kind of give us a kind of roundhouse view of some of the organizations that you either work with or participate in?
Sure. Well, you know, I really want to use right on a site. But also we're trying to promote those BMPs, or best management practices, what I was just talking about, and understand how best to install the systems, how best to operate and maintain those systems, and really streamline any standards and legislation that we need to really put forth to remove barriers for any of these localized water approaches. And it doesn't mean that we don't want to work with centralized approaches. We just want to make sure that we understand how to optimize what's going on at a site level and what those resources are. So that's really what CALA is trying to do. They also work with a lot of the service industry. I heard Chris earlier on the show, she's so great, trying to say there's a lot of jobs out there in water, and CALA is really trying to put forth a new integrated training curriculum and offer that to help you get certified and continue education units so you can find these other particular water jobs out there. So if you're looking for, again, a new career or even trying to transfer over into water, get more knowledge, CALA is developing, they already have a whole suite of curriculum, but they're trying to develop a new curriculum about these new integrated approaches for localized water systems. And it's really fascinating.
I think if more people, even the residents, start treating their property as a watershed and manage it that way, they can improve tons of things. Now, you were just up on the California Irrigation Institute on one of the panels, as was Chris Austin. But you sat on a panel that talked about alternate water sources for irrigation. Can you tell us a little about that?
Sure. Well, I mean, the panel had all kinds of really interesting reflections, but more than anything, I'd say I wanted to make sure to bring forth that alternative sources of water for irrigation. We might think of it as recycled water, and you have to get that from your municipality or your wastewater supplier, but that's not the case necessarily. There's different types of sources of alternative water you can use for irrigation that work. True, you have to know what you're doing, but there's stormwater, mechanical water, which is condensed water off of your air conditioning unit or cooling tower. There is rainwater harvesting, which is becoming more popular through the United States. There is gray water, which is appropriate in a lot of places, not in all, but in a lot of places. And so there's a lot of different alternative sources that don't require you to bring something in off-site. There's also black water recycling. And the most critical thing here, I think, is what the benefits are that it brings our homeowners and commercial businesses and ranchers and communities is, in most cases, this alternative water strategy brings us, of course, less reliance on depletion of our critical water supply. And so we don't want to use our fresh drinking water on irrigation. So that's obviously one benefit. But secondly, we found that there's, through testing, quite a bit of nutrient cycling that can go on site. There's reduction of greenhouse gases and energy because you're not having to pump it so far. You're creating habitat on site. People tend to water trees or plants more thoroughly and build soils and habitat. And you're able to essentially get more fruit off of your fruit. I love gray water, by the way. You can use it in ways that are really protective for a property to decrease fire risk. For a wild and urban interface, like a fire buffer, which they're finding that hydrated landscapes are really important for fire resilience. And so, again, using those alternative water sources to promote hydration of the soil, I think is critical. There's all kinds of other things we can talk about, reduction of flooding on properties and other things. But I think for us to think about, there's all these different benefits to using alternative water for irrigation. And we never, I don't think we usually discuss that when we're usually discussing alternative water.
It's a pretty broad subject. I mean, you know, we've had the show here for 5 years, Regina, and had lots and lots of people on, different discussions. We know there's a lot of companies out there, including yours, that are doing work and education and outreach, talking about water reuse, recycling gray water and all that stuff. But really, it really needs to be applied to the individual levels of use, like at the residential level. It's a different application than at the commercial level, than at the industrial level, and then, you know, further on where the greatest water use is, and that's in farming or in ag. You have any comments on that subject?
Well, I mean, as far as, you know, I'm a farmer's daughter, so I grew up farming cotton ranching down in the San Joaquin Valley, and I would say there's just so many different thought processes maybe with timing of water and healthy soils, and there's so much we're learning about soils right now, and trying to bring the idea of these multiple benefits or values. Floodmar is one of them that I know CWR is really pushing. But to really look at what are the timing of those crops or different ways that we can layer on different functions so that we can get more with the type of farming that we're doing or ranching that we're doing on the land use. And sometimes there's a way for us to, you know, farm water. Sometimes there's a way for us to, you know, farm soil or carbon in a way that we also can get, you know, some other crop out of it. So for us to think outside the box, I think is really the future of farming.
In the application for farming, and it's great that you're a farmer's daughter, so is my wife. No worries about that. and Rob, maybe this is a question for you to ask, because I know this is a subject dear to your heart, but do you envision different types, different processes for farming, like vertical farming and that sort of thing?
You know, I do. I think it's so contextual to where you are, and I don't think it works for every size of farmer. And of course, I definitely want to pay homage to the larger farmers out there, but also more importantly to the smaller farmers. And that's more of my history. And so I know for vertical farming, it works really well for some smaller farmers, but it can be really expensive. And it depends if you're in a certain microclimate. So I know enough about it to be a little dangerous, but I'd say us looking at different methods like the Chilean method for tree cropping that can almost go down to like a dry crop for avocados, and for us to come up and really be open to looking for different testing of these types of microclimate-based farming methods that are contextual to that farmer. And, of course, the irrigation methods that are associated, because some of the irrigation methods are completely different.
Right.
But to support those farmers to try those things, that's the most important thing. These guys are and women are out there. I think you said earlier in the show that there's really no young farmers out there, and I wanted to chime in because I know a lot of young farmers who are trying to really move into the field, and they see it as something they want to try to move into, and to try to advocate for the large farmers, the old farmers, the new farmers, and all different types, that we can experiment, and it's okay to fail, and it's okay to learn together.
That's right. See, I think vertical farming, I don't see that to be used like for cotton or for almond trees or fruit trees and
right.
things like that.
Yeah.
But I see things like small vegetables and things of that. There's companies back east that have warehouses because they use 90% less water. They don't have to use
right.
a lot of chemicals because there's not a lot of bugs and insects that can get in the buildings. They don't have to worry about the weather because it's temperature controlled. They use these special LED lights to simulate solar. So for those kind of crops, I think that's going to be really interesting because it does save a lot of things, and you can package smaller, you know, like lettuce and things of that. The bigger stuff, like I said, with like almonds and
yeah.
trees and stuff, and avocados, it can't be done inside.
Yeah, a lot of the row crops, though, are conducive to vertical farming, right? Not stone fruits and
right.
nuts, but yeah.
Mm.
All right.
And I would also add that some of the vertical farming, I think, can also replenish the soils depending on, again, the context. So that's something we really want to look at as well, how we're able to replenish these soils that we're finding that are more and more critical.
Well, I know in Israel they utilize seawater. Which has a high salinity rate, but they're growing. Their scientists are using their microbiologists to help grow produce that can use the salinity in the water and won't harm it. I don't know I haven't seen much of that here in the U.S. Maybe it's going on. We just don't know about it. But that's
right.
kind of an interesting thing. I mean, you got so much water in the ocean. I mean, that's the biggest.
Yep. Yep.
Place that and the atmosphere; those are the two places where you get the water. And even you know, there's tons of companies cropping up now. I use that word cropping up for ag.
Ta-da.
Yeah. All right, I'll keep my day job. Anyway, because one of the things they want to see is this water harvesting, and a lot of
right.
companies are doing that. And
yeah.
I think that can serve a purpose. I don't know how well it can do in gigantic fields. Because you need huge systems to do that, but people are claiming they can do stuff like that. I don't know.
Yeah. So on the future of water, especially here in California, because this is where we're at and where you live, Regina. But what do you see as the future of California water? Not just California, maybe the U.S. I'll broaden that question for you.
Yeah, if you were going to talk about California water, I'd say, oh, collaboration, especially after the governor's. The announcement that you guys were talking about.
Yes. Yes, and by the way, you can chime in anytime you want, Regina. We have an open mic policy here, so no problem.
Well, I mean, I'd really want to say collaboration, but I also, you know, I kind of see myself in the rocking chair on the front porch of my great grandmother's house, looking back at us right now and saying, you know, I feel like we're just, you know, the water sciences and the ecological sciences and ag science, you know, we're so close to really understanding more about where we are and what water does. And we also know there's a lot of conservation science. And these are young sciences, but I feel like we're just on this edge. So as far as the future of water, I feel like we're going to find out that we're going to understand that the water cycle is a little bit different or more connected than what we thought it was. We're going to understand surface and groundwater, which will be a big, well, I told you so. Someone will be out there, you know, well, I told you that the water from the Sierras went under the valley. But we're really going to get that larger picture of how it moves through the plants and the atmosphere and soils. And I think that that's going to bring us together. Now, we don't have to wait that long. I think a lot of cultures already know how the water moves through a lot of soils and plants and atmosphere. You know, a lot of the tribes, I think a lot of ranchers and farmers really know the land, have a good sense of that water cycle, and we've lost it. But I think this will be a common thread, this marriage of new technology and understanding of the water cycle will hopefully bring us together. And I think we're kind of at this precipice right now. We have all these different divisions in the water sector, and we're kind of fighting amongst ourselves about who's doing what. And at some point, I think the technology and maybe the land stewardship and some of our old knowledge is going to kind of bring us together and unite us. And I hope that's a common thread that we look at throughout the nation and even the world once we start to really understand how special water is and how it moves.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a finite resource, really. The planet's got all the water it has, and it's going to have.
That's right. It's never getting more. Hey, maybe you can tell us a little bit, because you and I had an earlier conversation on the phone today, but the history of the Mountain Sage Nursery and the property and all the what the business encompasses. And I was amazed at looking at your website. Can you kind of tell our audience about it?
It's the story as promised.
Beautiful place.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's I think I started here at Forsado. My grandmother lived up in Groveland. She moved up there with her family and met my grandfather, who named the Iron Door. If you guys go to Groveland, there's a saloon there called the Iron Door Saloon, and he named it. My grandmother met him and fell in love. And essentially, they have a homestead from 1867. That when I decided to do something different to reach non-point source pollution treatments with my husband, we moved to Groveland and essentially acquired an old family homestead. We turned it into a nursery and community center and photo gallery. My husband's a USGS field biologist turned award-winning photographer. And so there's a full photo gallery, and there's 70 to 90-year-old grapevines and pecan trees and walnuts. Outside, there's a barn from 1860 on the property. And so we have community events.
We're coming up. Chris and I are
coming
up.
How awesome.
We're just going.
Let's go.
It's just a really great community hub. And, you know, my great aunt had chickens. How's everything grow so well here? Well, you know, she raised chickens for Save Mart down in the valley, and so there was just great soil. So it's a nice little mecca. If anyone's on the way up to Yosemite and you want to stop, take a rest, it has a very inviting feel to it, I think, because my family was always on the front porch making dinner, inviting anybody who walked by on the street to come by and have dinner with them, have some ravioli. And Keep it.
Well, the only thing you're missing, you got the nursery, you got the coffee shop, you got a restaurant, you got a photo gallery, you got the grapevines. Do you have any? Is it got a little motel there that we?
Well, no. Well, there is 20 acres, so we're trying to work on essentially what our plan is, that really revitalize Groveland and work with the community. So we're hoping to, you know, at some point maybe put in a campground.
Oh, awesome.
But there's some really great hotels. There's a Charlotte Hotel and the Groveland Hotel right there. You can walk. And I was really also trying to put in best management practices there so that people who come there and they're happy, they're on vacation, can learn about water and different ways in which they can use their land in order to manage their landscape and their water use.
Wow.
So come on by.
We will. Hey, in the really got 2 minutes left, but if I was the governor and I dubbed you the czar of water in California, what would be the top three issues you would address immediately?
I would say collaboration. We really just need to have the state put their. I mean, I know the governor said we need to have voluntary agreements to really help support collaborations and guidance. I'd say we need to think big. We need to think outside our boxes. We used to think big. We used to go to the moon and water management, and now we're a little afraid of each other, so I wanted to break through barriers. And I'd say we do need to think about how we want to have a sense of place and look back to where, you know, our ranchers, farmers, tribal elders, others, how did they know how water worked on their land and actually look back to that? Because I think going back to the simplistic is there's a lot of information there we're missing.
It's that kind of tribal knowledge and that you know, we know how to do it because nature told us how, kind of thing.
Yeah, or you experiment it. Have no choice. Well, I got to appreciate you coming on our show today, Regina, and it was absolutely awesome. And we do thank you very much. And how can they get a hold of your company and your nursery?
Well, you can go to www.watershedprogressive.com, and that is the easiest way to get a hold of us.
Great.
And there's also localizingcaliforniawater.com or CALA.org.
Excellent.
Any of those three ways. Thank you for having me.
We sincerely appreciate you coming on the show today, and it was great talking with you, and I hope our listeners enjoyed that, and want you to go check out that place called Mountain Sage Nursery. Sounds like heaven to me. Come on by.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, Regina. You have a great